It's only one empire state. This is KUOW's The Record. Welcome, I'm Bill Radke. It is only one state, but by winning New York's primary yesterday, Hillary Clinton ended a string of Bernie Sanders' victories, including Sanders' overwhelming win here in Washington. Now, it's still not settled. Neither candidate has enough delegates yet to wrap up the nomination. But some Democratic Party leaders would like to see Sanders leave so they can start focusing on the November election. Is it time for Bernie Sanders to head for the exit? Let's ask two people now. Sarah Leonard is senior editor at The Nation, and Chris Parker is political science professor at the University of Washington. Welcome to you both. And Sarah, let's begin with you. Is it time for Bernie to make his exit? He's made his point?
I don't think so. For starters, there are 19 primaries and caucuses remaining. And this is not someone who came in as a protest candidate and won one state and then faded into the background. This is someone who has won 15 states. And given that there are 19 left, I do wonder whether it's right and whether it's democratic to deny the voters in all of those states the right to choose between the two candidates.
Chris, undemocratic to expect Bernie Sanders to step away at this point?
Bernie needs to exit left, right, and center. I agree with what a lot of what he's saying. I mean, I actually like him better than I do Hillary, and I don't think I'm alone in that. However, if we want to win this election, we need to heal the party a whole lot sooner than July when the convention takes place. I will agree with Sarah that some could construe this as unsmall-D democratic in a sense that, you know, these voters need to have their say. But I think in the end, these voters ultimately would like to retain the White House. So thinking about it from a pragmatic perspective, then Bernie needs to leave.
Sarah, would Bernie Sanders staying in hurt the Democrats' chances of taking the White House? Why or why not?
I do not think it will hurt the Democrats. I mean, something we're thinking about is Bernie Sanders, and Hillary supporters say this too, has of course moved Hillary to the left. And one of the things that this has done for the party is it's actually broadened the Democratic coalition somewhat, especially by exciting young people who it seems like were not extremely enthused about the party before Bernie Sanders entered it. So why would you not want to bring that all the way to the convention? That seems desirable for the Democratic Party as well as for Bernie Sanders, and hopefully is helping Hillary to develop a platform that's actually more appealing in these times of economic distress. And further, one thing that Bernie Sanders has done that's been very productive is to endorse down-ticket candidates like Pramila Jayapal, actually, in your 7th district. And other candidates have endorsed Bernie in order to tie their politics and their platform to something that's clearly very popular. And so this isn't just about Bernie Sanders, even. This is about bringing all of those people forward and creating this shift in the Democratic Party. So I think it would be strange, actually, if he gave up his platform and, in a way, their platforms this early in the race.
I want to ask Chris about the helpfulness or not of moving to the left in a moment. But first, Sarah, I've heard this before. Sanders moves Clinton to the left. Is that on rhetoric or is that on policy? And if it's policy, what is the number one example of how Sanders staying in the race moves Clinton to the left on platform, on policy?
Well, the fight for 15 is the most obvious, right? When she came into the race, she thought $12 was a good place for the minimum wage, even though there was a strong movement in the U.S. for a $15 minimum wage, which Bernie supported. Through the debates, she has since come to embrace a $15 minimum wage and had a press conference actually about it with Andrew Cuomo. Someone else who actually did not help the fight particularly, but now wants to talk a lot about it. And I do think there's a sort of myth going around that, you know, Hillary will never be able to get the votes of Bernie Sanders supporters, and that's why he needs to drop out early in order to get them on board quickly. But the fact is that as she adopts more parts of his platform, his voters become more likely to move over to her. And so this is actually a very productive process when we're looking at the general election. And I do think that when voters are faced with, should we vote for Clinton even though we liked Bernie, or should we allow Donald Trump or Ted Cruz to start picking Supreme Court nominees, I think it's going to be pretty clear. I mean, Bernie himself has said he looks forward to, you know, the Democrat having the endorsement of their opponent.
Chris, Sarah says a continued contested election does not put Sanders' votes at risk. What do you think of that? Is there a risk of a Democratic fight that doesn't end well?
I think, well, first of all, let me just say this. It's an empirical question about whether or not, that if Bernie drops out, whether or not, his voters or his supporters will stay with Hillary or will go with Hillary or not if he doesn't endorse her. I would imagine that Bernie would necessarily endorse her. Beyond that, he's already proven his point. I mean, he's already proven, like Sarah just said, most notably on the $15 minimum wage, he's already successfully moved her to the left, right? So all he would have to do is just endorse her and say, we need to come together. Because otherwise, you're going to continue to have a split party all the way through. I mean, think about the 1964 Republican National Convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco between Goldwater and Rockefeller. That was an extremely contested and vitriolic convention. The same thing with Reagan and Ford in 1976, rather. So these things in the Democratic Party, you had Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter, and look what happened. Reagan wound up winning because the party was divided. So I don't think we can gainsay. I mean, these things have happened in history, right? So these are not subject to speculation. So I would say that we need to have a more unified party as we approach the convention, because we don't want to run the risk of having someone worse than Ronald Reagan in the White House.
Okay, we have about a minute left. Sarah, Chris's point is $15 minimum wage. Got it. Check. What do you want? What's the number one thing you want Sanders to accomplish now by staying in the race?
Well, what he's doing right now is creating, as he has throughout the entire race, increased momentum for a set of left-wing ideas on economic policy, on trade, on policing, that have no... Everybody agrees these have moved Hillary to the left. And the only way that that worked was that he remained a threat long enough that she had to take him seriously. If he had just announced these things from a mountaintop without challenging her access to the nomination, obviously these would not be things that would be discussed. So why he would stop doing that now, I don't know. I would take issue with those historical examples, because what we're looking at is most likely not a super contentious, heavily contested convention like the ones you're describing, but rather one where, in the end, Bernie Sanders enthusiastically endorses Clinton, as he's basically said he will do, and the party has a fairly eventful convention where the most dramatic question is whether Bernie Sanders gets prime time or whether they put him lower on the schedule.
Chris Parker, will you have your chance to address that point when you join us again here on KUOW?
Yeah,
we're out of time.
More, yes.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more. That's our time for now. Chris Parker is a poli-sci professor here at the University of Washington, and you also heard from Sarah Leonard, senior editor at The Nation. Chris and Sarah, thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Offering two different points of view there on what is the right next move for Bernie Sanders, given a big victory yesterday in the New York primary by Hillary Clinton. Now, that victory in Washington State by Bernie Sanders, an overwhelming and important win for him, just shored up Washington State's, especially Seattle's, reputation as a left-leaning place, right? Seattle voters have that reputation as a left-leaning place. They elected a socialist city council member. They voted for $15 an hour, a minimum wage. Actually, the lefty reputation in Seattle is older than that. Starting in the beginning of the 20th century, union leader Eugene V. Debs looked here to Washington and thought, this is a place where I could build a socialist state. History professor James Gregory at the University of Washington told Ross Reynolds why Debs saw so much lefty potential in Washington.
Well, there were good reasons. It was a brand new state, only 9 years since statehood, and very recently, just that year, had elected its third governor, John Rogers, on the populist ticket. So Rogers was a radical. The Populist Party was quite radical. And so the socialists thought, it's already started. Let's move to Washington.
They thought fertile territory. And he had a plan to get a bunch of people out here, as you say, to colonize, to kind of get a lot of socialists here to convert the state. What was the plan?
Well, the plan was to convince people to go, and he got a lot of publicity when he gave an interview, I think, to the Associated Press, proclaiming that he could, he said, convince 100,000 unemployed workers in Chicago alone to get on trains and come to Washington State. And that got headlines and caused quite a lot of consternation among conservatives in Washington.
So. Yeah, what was the reaction when they heard that 100,000 unemployed Chicagoans were going to be coming to Washington State to turn it into a socialist state?
Yeah, several newspapers were not at all happy about that. But, you know, what was interesting is that the plan sort of fell apart and sort of went forward. Debs lost interest, realized, well, this isn't going to be so easy, and there are better ways to build a socialist movement. But several hundred socialists did sell their life belongings in various states and moved to Washington State and established a number of colonies, the first and sort of most famous of which was called Equality. And it was established in Whatcom County, not too far from Bellingham, and about 300 families built sawmills and dormitories and schools and published a newspaper there and proceeded with this plan to try to convince to win elections in Washington State.
And people who go to Whidbey Island, they see the town of Freeland, which actually has its origins back with the Eugene Debs Initiative, right?
Exactly. Freeland started as a socialist colony. And many of these colonies didn't last very long. Equality burned down and people left. Freeland lasted a while longer. There was a very interesting colony at Burley on Kitsap Peninsula and another one which had the great name Home, H-O-M-E. It was sort of more anarchistic than socialist, and that lasted a long time. That's down on the Kitsap Peninsula. There's still a cute neighborhood that celebrates that heritage.
Ironic, isn't it, that the anarchistic colony would last longer than the socialist colonies?
Yeah, well, they were in some ways doing things a little better. They were looser about all the forms of organization, and some people lived there as late as the 1960s.
We're talking about Washington State and Seattle's reputation as a left-leaning place. So we learned how Washington State got this left-leaning reputation in the early 1900s, even before that. Let's focus on Seattle now. And part of what you cover is how the Great Depression helped to cement the city's left-leaning reputation. Tell us what was going on in Seattle during the Depression in the 30s.
Well, the Depression hit Washington State very hard, harder than the country as a whole. And unemployment rates probably hit about 35% at some points in maybe 1932. And in those days, unemployment pretty much led to homelessness because there was no unemployment insurance, and one-income families led to lots of desperation. So Seattle experienced big increases in homelessness and lots of desperation, but a kind of a community of radicals that had been around for decades mobilized some interesting responses to it. And I'm intrigued by the difference between what they did in the 30s and what people have done in the Great Recession.
These days, you can go across the street from KUOW and there's a small tent encampment. But there was what's called a Hooverville in Seattle back in the 1930s, which is a giant encampment.
Yeah, the biggest Hooverville was located near where the stadiums are today, and at some points had a couple of thousand residents. It lasted a long time and was talked about as the sort of biggest and longest lasting Hooverville in the country. The reason it lasted a long time was because of the political power that the unemployed movements developed in 1931 and 32. So a group not so much from the Hoovervilles but from West Seattle created an organization called the Unemployed Citizens League, where they gathered unemployed people and they shared work and barter clubs and various things, but they also figured out how to be very effective politically. They demanded of the city and state government jobs and relief services. By 1932, they had easily 10,000 members in Seattle, enough to influence the mayoral election that year. So when John Doerr was elected mayor in 1932, he owed his victory to this Unemployed Citizens League.
You say that Seattle has a reputation as a left-leaning place, but in reality, is it? We also know that part of our history was the activity of removing the Chinese, the Ku Klux Klan. Knut Berger has been documenting in Crosscut, a series, the Nazi activity that took place here before World War II. Is it that clear that we were a left-leaning city?
Well, I use the term reputation, and reputation and reality are way, way different, as we know. And in truth, Seattle has had a very checkered history of conservative eras and liberal eras, and never really have radicals been in charge. It's not a particularly radical city. We have this reputation. We've had some really electrifying incidents and some very powerful movements that come and go. But, you know, Seattle should never be thought of as a left-wing city.
And as in fact you've pointed out, there are some cities in the United States that have actually had far-left leadership.
Yeah, and the United States as a whole has this very kind of awkward, radical history of movements that come and go and are really very, very influential in the way that European left movements are. You know, there are cities and states and whole countries in Europe that are regularly governed by socialist parties or socialist-leaning parties. That's not the case in the United States. It is in Canada. You know, British Columbia's had the New Democratic Party, which is socialistic. The United States doesn't have that kind of history, but some states do, not ours. Milwaukee managed to elect socialist mayors for almost half a century. Vermont.
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Vermont seems to like to vote for now 30 years for a fellow who calls himself a democratic socialist. So there are places that have a more genuine claim to having a radical history.
That's University of Washington historian James Gregory questioning whether our left-leaning reputation is actually true, talking there with KUOW's Ross Reynolds. Now, you may have heard them discuss briefly Knute Berger's series in Crosscut about Nazi presence in Seattle in the 30s and 40s, so we're tweeting out a link to that excellent series right now. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. Coming up on The Record, the investigation into improper recruiting of Bellevue High School football players. Is that investigation racist? That's coming up in 15 minutes. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. So just a moment ago, we were discussing whether Washington is as progressive as our reputation. Carolyn, that would seem to lead us right into our chat.
Absolutely.
Carolyn Adolph, KUOW's economy reporter. You've been reporting this series on our regressive state tax system and other aspects of how we tax ourselves here.
Right, yes.
Progressives have called on Washington State to put in a state income tax to pay for things like education, a low income tax. But voters keep saying, no, you don't. A low income tax would inevitably get ratcheted up. So I want to ask you, are the income tax opponents correct about that?
It has happened. Absolutely. People who favor the tax talk about all the safeguards they're going to put in, but the sweep of history tells us something a little bit different. Remember, 40 states in this country, 41, have an income tax.
Right.
There's a whole bunch of experience about seeing those things rise. Now, the one thing I want to say is two reasons why taxes go up. One is the revenue is insufficient, and the other one is that government has grown. The stuff that government does has grown. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because what seems to be going on in our state is mostly that there's something going wrong with the revenue side.
Right. And a lot of opponents of an income tax, they want to keep government small. That's part of the idea.
Yes, they do.
So how do we know if government's too small?
Oh, I looked high and low for a metric for that. I never found it, and that was the thing I was most keen on doing. But the thing is, though, that we have one tiny metric, which is the state Supreme Court,
right,
looking at the system and saying something is wrong. The state is not funding the system sufficiently.
Yeah. So how do you know? We have this discussion about whether the income tax would be the camel's nose under the tent.
Yeah.
How do we know whether an income tax would go up over time?
Okay. So a lot of the proponents of an income tax want a flat one rate for everybody. Illinois has a flat tax. They pushed it up a couple of percentage points a few years ago, supposedly temporarily, but probably not, mm-hmm, because of an revenue crisis. And we've got five other states that have with graduated systems that create new tax brackets to go after the rich. So it's out there. It's a thing.
So is that it then? The critics are right. Taxes go up over time. Needs increase. So we just have this deadlock forever?
Well, the thing is, though, we have the Supreme Court ruling, which is needling us and could result in some change in the deadlock. But if there isn't any budge on the taxation side, if Washington voters are not willing to change anything there, it kind of pushes the weight in the other direction. And I mean, there's no consensus on how to do it, but if people have the stomach, there's always the state constitution.
The state constitution.
Well, so this is an idea floated by Treasurer James McIntyre, and he does not support this. But what he says is the state can't fully pay for education. Maybe we need to get into the state constitution and cut that section out. And if we did that, then that would free lower governments like counties and communities to pay for education, that somebody would have to step into that void. I mean, it would be not very good for equity. Poor districts would really struggle to fund education, but at least it would end the deadlock and something would be moving.
Finally, Carolyn, voters in Washington State have said no, no, and no. So
yep.
Now what?
Well, that's a good question. We're gonna see what happens at the Supreme Court when they start to ask the state how well they've been doing at getting at education. We'll just see if any rocks or hard places decide to move.
Carolyn Adolph, KUOW's economy reporter. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you.
And you can find that series I mentioned, her series Taxing Matters, is at the KUOW website. Search for that phrase, Taxing Matters. This is KUOW's The Record. Welcome. I'm Bill Radke. You are living in a spot known for gorgeous expanses of water all around us, from Puget Sound to Lake Washington to Commencement Bay. All of this water had one KUOW listener wondering, what's living beneath that surface?
My name is Renee Brathwaite. I live in Gig Harbor. I'm wondering, is there a giant octopus living underneath the Narrows Bridge?
Is there a giant octopus under the Narrows? Renee asked her question as part of our storytelling project, Local Wonder. And we sent KUOW's Kathy Ducharme out to dive into this rumor of a big octopus off the shores of Tacoma.
Our story starts here with Renee's son, Douglas, on the shores of Titlow Beach, which has a great view of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge.
I was about 15 years old when this little incident transpired.
He was walking down this beach with a girl he really liked.
You take a girl by the water, and that's definitely brownie points. It's romantic and what have you. So I think we might have even been holding hands. I'm not sure. And, I look out at the water, and I see this arm come out of the water. It's about 10, 15 feet in the air, and, it looked like an octopus or something like that. And I just took off running. I'm like, okay, later for all this. I don't know what that is. I'm gone.
But should Douglas have been afraid? Other people have seen plenty of giant octopuses around the Tacoma Narrows.
And the big octopuses, they're around.
That's Kerry Donahue. He's a commercial diver. His company helped build the new Tacoma Narrows Bridge.
They try to scare you. Basically, they're big defense mechanism. They get bigger than you are. And when they are, you're standing on the bottom in your helmet and fins, you're, 6'6". These things will bow up and tower above you. You're looking up at them.
The first time it happened, it scared the out of him. He screamed.
Because your radio's to the surface, you take a lot of flack for for screaming like a 2-year-old when you run into an octopus.
Donahue took flack because even though Puget Sound octopuses are the biggest in the world, they're not the sea monsters that seek out humans as prey.
They're great. They're efficient hunters. They're territorial. And I think one of their best skills is they can get into the tiniest places anywhere,
These are octopus delfleni, commonly called the giant Pacific octopus. They have an arm span of up to 20 feet. They can jam into small cracks and holes because their beaks are the only hard part of their bodies. And they're crafty. Donahue says one time a diver on his team was underwater. He was cutting metal with a burning rod. He had a stack of rods next to him. They kept disappearing.
And he's like, I'm losing my rods. So where are these going? And the visibility wasn't that great. And then he took a rod and from his hand and he put it out, and this tentacle comes snaking out and grabbed this Broca rod and took it from.
You can find giant Pacific octopuses all over Puget Sound, but the Narrows Bridge is a hot spot for them. To find out why, I went behind the scenes at the Seattle Aquarium with staff biologist Tim Carpenter.
smells like fish food.
You think?
Carpenter takes me to see an octopus that will eventually be on display.
This is Jelly Bean, one of our females that we have in holding. I think she already was fed today, so I can't really give her any food, but...
She's sticking to your fingers, Tim.
She She's exploring me. They can taste with their suction cups. I don't know if you knew about that.
What Jelly Bean likes to taste and eat are crabs, clams, fish, and shrimp, dead or alive. Carpenter says octos like Jelly Bean like the Tacoma Narrows because it's a giant buffet, a spread that's created in part from high, high current and massive upwellings that bring nutrient-rich waters to the Narrows.
Which then sets up that chain reaction to produce lots of different food, a variety of food items and an abundance of food items that the octopuses need, for sure.
That's how in 3 to 4 years, giant Pacific octopuses can reach 100 pounds.
They have an incredible capacity to grow very, very quickly. They can put on the pounds much more quickly than most other animals out in the natural world. And so they need a lot of food. They'll eat whatever they can get their tentacles on.
Sounds like something you'd want to run away from. But there was a time when divers went after octopuses. Bill High was one of them. He's a retired fisheries biologist.
Tell me what we're looking at.
This is Titlow Beach. This is in my earlier days, as you can imagine.
Good-looking guy. You still are.
We're looking at photos of Bill High in his days as a member of a dive club called the Mud Sharks. In the 1950s and 60s, the club ran a contest on the same beach Douglas took a walk on with that girl.
It's called the World Octopus Wrestling Championships.
That's right, a wrestling contest, man versus octopus. Divers hold their breath, swim down, they lure the octopus out of its den and try to bring it up. The octopus tries to escape, hence the wrestling part.
They don't usually pull your mask off, but quickly, they put an arm across your face mask.
High says the Mud Sharks canceled the contest after a few years. Instead of challenging the animals, they wanted to learn about them. And what they learned?
They're perfectly harmless. They're a reclusive animal, and they're just neat to know.
Today, there are 7 octopus protection areas in Puget Sound, so all divers can just watch the animals do their thing.
And if you ever have the opportunity to see one that is out in the open and you come upon it, they get up and they fly away. Using their jet propulsion, they just glide out across the water. You're just with this flying machine that's out there. Pretty exciting.
So let's go back to Douglas, the guy at the top of our story. Was the giant arm he saw come out of the water in Tacoma an octopus?
Just to see the giant arm come up as though it were this great creature from the deep that was coming up, that I would hesitate to believe. But strange things happen out there in the water.
I'm Kathy Ducharme in Tacoma.
That story was inspired by a question from listener Renee Brathwaite. You can see video of Jelly Bean the Octopus and all of our local wonder stories all at our website, KUOW.org. Thanks for the question, Renee. And while you're at our website, leave us your local wonder about the Puget Sound region. If your question is chosen, you know a KUOW reporter is going to investigate it. KUOW's The Record. Happy Wednesday. I'm Bill Radke. Bellevue High School football supporters are hitting back after an independent investigation found facts about the program breaking recruiting rules. Parents and supporters of the Bellevue High School football program now say the investigation is racially biased. I spoke with one of those parents. Marissa Spooner LaDuff is the godmother and legal guardian of one of the Bellevue football players. She and her godson, Tyson, were questioned during the investigation.
All of the black families. This wasn't a Tyson thing. This was all of the black families. And they were treated unfairly because, one, investigators would just show up to dig through our garbages, to call our landlords, to call our bosses, to ask about our incomes, to talk to our neighbors, to talk to us, to call us, to harass us with phones ringing constantly, to show up on our doorsteps unannounced. It's wrong. It's unacceptable. They went to my home in Seattle. They spoke to neighbors.
And are you saying no white players were treated the same way?
Absolutely. No white players. I actually tried to help them with their investigation by telling them, you know, you're starting to look a little prejudiced. And I gave them the name of the white families who had transferred in. And they, in turn, reached out to the white families, but they discussed the black kids. They asked us things like how we could afford to live in Bellevue, how we could afford to drive cars, what type of work my husband did, just things that just pointed towards racial bias. I mean, you go out to investigate, and all you do is investigate the black kids, the black families, where we come from, how we got here, why we're here, were we recruited here. That was their main thing. We had to have been recruited. Therefore, Bellevue football had to have paid for us because we can't afford it on our own because we're shiftless and lazy. So therefore, somebody must have helped us do this. There's just no way we could live in Bellevue. It's just far too expensive. And that's the sense that we started to feel, because by their questions, we had no other choice but to feel this way. And we became angry. We went through hurt, sleepless nights. I still go through them, tears. But this is just not acceptable. It is not acceptable.
Marissa, as you know, the investigators say this is not about race. They found facts regarding the allegations that boosters paid tuition for players at a private school that lets kids play football for Bellevue High, and that they gave out false addresses to make out-of-district players eligible. What is your response to those accusations?
They're just accusations. They are just accusations. I haven't seen those facts.
Well, you said you have a house in Seattle. Does Tyson live in Bellevue?
Yes, we have an apartment in Bellevue. I also have a house in Renton, one in Louisiana, property in Idaho. And so God has granted me the opportunities, along with my husband's job, to be able to live where we want. We moved to Bellevue because my husband's job wanted him east of Lake Washington for his territory. Well, I'm a city girl. I didn't want to move to Issaquah. So Bellevue was just right here. So I thought, oh, downtown Bellevue, my son goes to Bellevue High School. Well, we had to go through all of the hoops for Merrick to play Bellevue football. He was awarded the opportunity to play. Merrick graduates, goes on to college, and now I get Tyson, a homeless kid, who is at Federal Way High School, a state champion in track and field. And I could have moved back to my home in Seattle and had Tyson go to any Catholic school of my choosing or the public school in my community. Well, Bellevue High School was good for us. They treated my son well. They have an outstanding academic program as well as a great sports program. So I'm trying to offer this kid the same opportunities I gave my own son, so I put him at Bellevue High School.
Marissa, what do you want to see happen next?
What I want to see happen is the truth come out, both sides, because it's wrong. And this is Washington where, oh, we must not be racist here. Well, white people don't walk in our brown skin, so many people think naturally or have a knee-jerk response that, oh, they're just playing the race card. Now, this isn't the race card because I'm not one to call the race card. And I have to say that as far as being hopeful, you want to be, the kids, they're not hopeful. I don't see Tyson hopeful. I watch Tyson have difficulty sleeping and just feeling like, well, you know, why are you still going through this? Nothing's going to happen. A lot of the black parents, it's just like, oh, it's just another waste of time. We grew up with all of this. And so our kids are just going to have to grow up with it. It'll just make them stronger. And that is just not right. It's just not right.
Marissa Spooner-LaDuff, Her godson is a senior at Bellevue High. He transferred to the school and played on the football team. Marissa was questioned as part of this investigation. The Bellevue School District and investigators from the Washington Interscholastic Activities Association did not respond to our requests for interviews this morning. The Bellevue School District is looking into complaints of harassment and bullying during the investigation. However, both investigators and the school district have said that this investigation had no racial motivation or bias. We're going to keep following the story here on KUOW Seattle. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. A Seattle advisory board says the city should set up BYOB-type drinking zones in the city. Now, that might make you think of a beer garden where you can bring your own drink, but this is not Oktoberfest. I talked about it with Lisa Dugard, who's on this advisory board, the Community Policing Commission. She told me that these designated consumption zones would be a response to a problem the city is having with public intoxication. Actually, two problems.
The first is that it is a felt problem in Seattle neighborhoods that people are drinking alcohol and using drugs in public and in ways that are problematic from a neighborhood public order perspective. Separately, from a police reform perspective, public consumption citations, because consuming drugs or consuming marijuana or alcohol are civil violations under the city code, those citations, when they're issued by the Seattle Police Department, are issued in a way that disproportionately focus on African Americans and Native Americans for alcohol and African Americans for marijuana. So those are two very different observations. They happen to dovetail in our report because they both sort of independently suggest that it would be good to take a different approach.
Is the person you have in mind a homeless person, a chronic inebriate? Who are you imagining using these sites?
That's a good point. I think it is our understanding that the problem to be solved for is that of people who are addicted and consume substances on the street chronically. Neighborhood leaders are very clear that that is not the sum total of the problem presented by public drinking in particular, and that there is a significant problem, particularly in Pioneer Square, with sports fans who consume alcohol in public, and that there is an accountability issue for that population as well. I don't think that the CPC anticipates that the designated beer gardens are going to be used by Seahawks fans, you know.
Right.
So there's no question that these solutions are primarily for a portion of the population that engages in this behavior and are unlikely to be used by some other people who are admittedly posing problems for particular neighborhoods.
Okay, so you're proposing this idea of safe consumption sites. What are those? How would they work?
The idea of safe consumption sites is that, you know, while we might all wish that, you know, nobody was addicted to drugs or alcohol, people are, and they're not going to stop their use overnight, given that if you can organize where and how that use takes place in ways that assist people over time in reducing or giving up those substances, that's beneficial to the people. And if you can organize that in such a way that it basically allows legitimate enforcement in all other areas of the city, then that's a net plus for neighborhoods.
Okay, public health experts and eventually city council members would be asking a whole bunch of questions to sort out the details. How would these safe consumption sites work? Where would they be? Who could use them? I want to know, what effect do you think these safe consumption sites would have on the people who would use in these designated areas?
The hoped-for effect is that, you know, people are, at worst, no worse off, right? That this does no harm. But that for many people, it's the beginning of connection to an array of support services that eventually facilitate that person reducing or eliminating their use of substances. That is not required, but it still happens.
Lisa, despite your good intentions, would the city also be telling people, we're going to help you be an alcoholic, we're going to help you use and hurt yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's, you know, a widespread misconception about harm reduction based approaches, and these safe consumption approaches are harm reduction approaches. If no one was currently out there drinking and using drugs in public, that would be a legitimate concern, but they are. It is not that the problem is created by the response. The response is accepting the reality that people are drinking, people are using drugs, and those people are not all going to stop that use overnight, nor can they. That just flies in the face of the reality of how addiction plays out, as many, many people know from experiences in their own family. And so this is a reality-based solution. It takes seriously the neighborhood public order issues that we heard about. Those are legitimate problems. We are saying, let's get serious about actually making an impact on those. Citations don't. Nobody that we talked to contended that citations were likely to actually change behavior. So I guess what we're saying is, if you like the status quo, by all means, let's keep doing what we're doing. We are not sensing a huge enthusiasm for the status quo out there. So for all of us who would like to see it be better, what realistically can accomplish that? And harm reduction approaches do reduce people's use over time. They do make things better, which is not the same as perfect, but better is better for everybody.
Better is better. Lisa Dugard is a member of an independent advisory board in Seattle called the Community Policing Commission. That commission has just released this recommendation that the city of Seattle create safe consumption sites for the legal use of alcohol and marijuana. This is KUOW's The Record. Washington is one of the very few American states to have legal doctor-assisted suicide. In Canada, the national government just tried to pass a right-to-die law. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, I understand there's pushback on this law.
Yeah, we got our law. The Government of Canada bill was ordered by the country's highest court, the Supreme Court of Canada, to do something. They've done it, but they have not avoided controversy. This piece of legislation tabled last week is very controversial. A lot of people saying it doesn't go far enough. A lot of people saying it's vague, disappointing. So the controversy is not over by any means.
Yes. What's the controversy over a law that may not go far enough when it comes to medical assisted death?
Well, I'll give you a couple of things. So the basic principle is that you will be able to seek medical assistance to hasten your end. In circumstances defined in the law as, for example, intolerable pain, but the other thing the law says is that your death mustn't be reasonably foreseeable. So someone with a chronic degenerative condition, Lou Gehrig's disease would be one example, they're not going to die for a long time, but their condition may be intolerable to them in any event, and they may be seeking death because of it. Another area of controversy in the piece of legislation is you can't give informed consent ahead of time. So if you think if you don't want to be maintained as a vegetable or with dementia where you can't recognize your family and everything, you can't consent to that ahead of time. A third area of controversy, so you can seek medical assistance if you're in intolerable pain with a condition that is going to be fatal, but you have to wait 15 days. Now, someone said that, talk about cruel and unusual punishment. If you're asking for death because the pain is intolerable, what kind of a government's going to make you wait 2 weeks to think it over? You're not able to think at all. That's the whole point of the pain.
What do you think will happen next with this, Vaughn?
I think there's a couple of things could happen. It's very early, Bill. The government has the votes in Parliament probably to put this through, although they're saying that all members of Parliament will be allowed to vote their own consciences. They won't be forced to vote the party line. It's possible that amendments will be introduced into Parliament, so that would, you know, address some of these concerns. Another possibility, of course, is that Canada's upper house, the Senate, which is appointed, could hold up the legislation. There's been some indications they may do that. And the third one, and this is probably the most likely, is whatever the government and the Senate do in enacting this legislation, it'll be challenged in court because some of the lawyers who've been involved in previous court challenges, including the one that led to the Supreme Court of Canada ruling in 2015, some of those lawyers say this thing's going to go back to court because it doesn't really deal with the problem that was the High Court originally imagined being addressed.
Now, on another subject, Vaughn, we are early into forest fire season, and I understand British Columbia has already registered 132 fires?
Yeah, you may be early into the forest fire season, but British Columbia is not. Northern and northeastern British Columbia is very, very dry. In fact, Premier Christy Clark of British Columbia is up in the northeast today talking to firefighters. 132 fires already. This is the earliest start on a bad forest fire season we've had in 10 years. There's already been at least one evacuation of 500 people from their homes. Now, the weather people and the forest people, Bill, are saying that a bad start like this doesn't mean necessarily a bad season. We might get rain later in the year. We may have a very wet late spring or early summer, so it's too soon to say we're headed for a record season, but it's pretty disturbing. This is the largest number of fires we've had this early in a forest fire season in more than 10 years.
We just have a minute left, Vaughn. I'd like to think of British Columbia as being my neighborhood, but you're reminding me how it's not quite, because here in Seattle, we've been celebrating the return of rain and snowpack, and it's only recently been hot and sunny.
Yeah, the coast is such a place for microclimates, right? Like, we can have one section of the province dry as a bone and bursting into flame and another part soaking wet. I mean, it's one of the charms of the Pacific Northwest, but in this case, as I say, in northern British Columbia and northeastern British Columbia, major concern about wildfires.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, good to talk with you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in.